I'm very happy now to welcome Dr. Andrew Lustig. He is an EMT, he's a naturopathic doctor, and he's recently returned from the Philippines, where he was doing disaster relief after the typhoon that hit the Philippines in early November of last year. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks. Great to be back.
So this typhoon was a really world-class disaster. Over 6,000 people were killed. Tens of thousands were injured. How did you end up going there?
Well, let me just start by saying that actually my understanding is that, well, more than 6,000 people died, and the statistics that we're getting are not accurate, and I can talk a little bit about that later. I ended up going to Typhoon Haiyan through a group called Doctors Outreach Clinic. They're out of Kansas University. A friend of mine, Dr. Matthew Marquette, asked me to come. He said, how soon can you get here? And he was already on the ground. He told me the conditions and what was going on, and it was a few days before Thanksgiving, so I left the day after Thanksgiving. Of course, I've worked in other disasters, and I thought I knew what I might need to bring with me, and I was able to collect a lot of medicine, donated medicine mostly from St. Vincent's Foundation, the hospital here, and get it all together in time to leave.
And so what did you find? What were the first things you saw when you got there?
You know, travel into disaster areas has got its own etiology, right? So what happens is, you know, a military force has generally got to come in and quell the unrest, get the airport cleared, and allow people like myself to get in without coming on military C-130s. I was able to come in on a commercial flight, though they're very unreliable, and if there is a C-130 on the tarmac, you just have to wait hours sometimes to get in, even maybe the next day. So I was fortunate enough to get into Tacloban City, which is the epicenter of the typhoon. When I got there, there was a destroyed airport with no roof, and you know, I collected my bags. I got a vehicle. There are vehicles that are operating there. And
are the roads clear enough to use
some of the roads were clear and some of them were not. You know, when you show up at a disaster the first few days, and I was not there the first few days, it's really hard to get around. But people are generally very industrious about how to do that, and they've got little mopeds and motorcycles, and they move a log here and there, and they work their way around it. And so I was able to get a ride to a hospital where I was going to work out of, which was also missing its roof, but, you know, had a cement floor for me to pitch my tent in.
And what were the immediate needs that you were there to treat?
So I started to talk about the kind of etiology of a disaster. Initially, you're going to deal with significant trauma. You're going to deal with displaced people. You're going to deal with crime and violence in terms of people trying to get food and so on. I showed up, you know, 2 weeks later. So much of that had already been handled by the medical people that had arrived before me. We were still dealing with trauma, infection, you know, gangrene. We're dealing with a lot of typical developing country diseases like hypertension, sanitation issues that lead to, you know, diarrhea, malnutrition. We deal with lots of fungal infections and tetanus shot needs and lacerations and so on.
Some of these sound like things that are needs even in a non-disaster situation. Is that true?
It is. And you know, you go to a developing country and they have these kind of prolonged, difficult health issues that don't get better because the water doesn't get cleaner. But in a disaster where even the basic, you know, forms of sustenance are gone, you're going to deal with it much more. In this particular case, and I've seen this a couple other places, they were burning a lot of debris to get rid of just garbage, bodies, you know, everything. And they were inhaling those toxic fumes. And that just led to an enormous amount of respiratory issues, headaches, you know, everything that kind of goes with breathing and toxic fumes, asthma and all that.
And so what did you bring with you?
You know, with like very little notice, St. Vincent's, Christa St. Vincent's came through and gave me 200 pounds of medicine. You know, I just basically took with me everything from IV and IV supplies to oral antibiotics to IV antibiotics to hypertension drugs, surgical equipment, you know, suturing, wound care, bandage, all that.
Now, you are both an EMT and a naturopathic doctor, so are you basically doing the same kinds of things that MDs are doing?
So this is the way it works. Clearly, in a disaster, licensing and exact care is not as much on the forefront where it would be in normal conditions in the United States or elsewhere. So what I do is I work as a naturopathic doctor to understand the problem, and it's never an issue for me to understand what the health issue is. You know, are we dealing with, you know, epigastric issues? Are we dealing with respiratory issues? Are we needing analgesics? Are we needing hypertensive drugs? Are we needing heart medications? It's no problem getting to that conclusion. I sometimes bring homeopathic medicine, but typically in disasters, I will work with Western meds, and I work with other MDs. It's possible that somebody needs oral antibiotics, and I may not know the pediatric dose. And so I will turn around to a doctor that I'm working with and say, hey, what's the pediatric dose for? You know, we all work as a team. Nobody's doing surgery that has no license to do surgery. I've been in surgical suites and been asked to assist, but of course I'm not exceeding my scope of practice. So
you were working with one American group while you were there?
Actually, the way it worked out was I worked with a number of different medical teams at the hospital I was at, which is called RTR Hospital, which is actually owned by the Marcos family, Imelda Marcos, Fernando Marcos family. In fact, their house is across the street. They had several.
Did their house survive?
They actually didn't do too bad. For some reason, their roof stayed on, but the hospital across the street where I was camping out lost their roof. And they also, as a side note, they let us use their helicopters to get to areas that were not reachable by ground transportation. And they offered immense amounts of donated product to the hospital. I mean, they do own the hospital. But I ended up working with groups from all over the world. I worked with Korean doctors. I worked with doctors from China. I worked with doctors out of Manila, which was completely untouched, by the way. Manila's, you know, a thriving metropolis that was untouched. People were Christmas shopping, you know, it's just...
Right.
And so we had doctors from Manila, and the hospital would basically coordinate how many doctors we needed on each medical mission. And if we had only one doctor and we expected to see hundreds of patients, they'd say, hey, you two doctors, can you come with us? And we need some nurses. And so it was kind of almost like freelancing, basically, or working with a locums type of, you know, doctor placement group, and they would just place us, basically.
Did you have to have translators?
We did. We worked with translators, and I worked with translators all over the world, and you can't rely 100% because, you know, I've been in situations where I understood the language a little bit. I don't speak Nepalese, and I don't speak, you know, Creole and all that, but I understood enough to know that the translator was missing something, you know. The patient was nauseated and vomiting, but the motion that I was offering looked like sneezing, and so the translator said, are you sneezing, to the patient, and no, that wasn't what I was asking. And so, you know, you got to be careful, but yes, I work with translators.
Besides all the physical problems that people have after disaster, there's also the emotional aspect of trauma, which also has to be dealt with. Is that in your purview, or are other people dealing with that?
You know, again, we're kind of back to this process of what happens in disasters where all people work to help everybody and they're not exceeding their level of skill. But to be honest with you, just finding a family that has lost their children and talking to them, whether you are a licensed psychologist or not, is really an awesome thing to do, and is what they need. And you know, you show up and you're wearing a stethoscope and you have resources and you have intellect and you have just an understanding of how to help people. So to answer that question, there is some social work involved, and we all kind of contribute to that because we're there as caring human beings. In fact, I worked with one young lady who was able to get all of the children singing and playing games and using crayons so that they didn't get in the line to get free vitamins, for instance. Because there are people that are well but just want anything you're giving out.
Right.
You know, it's something versus nothing at all. And in one particular case, we had, you know, hundreds of children playing these games and being, you know, having a great time and hearing the laughter in the background while we worked with patients that really needed us. It was great.
We're talking to Dr. Andrew Lustig about his work in the Philippines after the Typhoon Haiyan, which happened in early November. You were there in December. What was the city like? First of all, what city were you in, and what was it like before the typhoon hit?
I arrived on the 29th of November, and the typhoon hit about 2 weeks earlier. Tacloban City is a typical developing country metropolis that has maybe 200,000 people. They have electricity and running water that's sometimes unreliable. They have, you know, restaurants and markets and so on. After the typhoon, of course, all of that was leveled. There was just nowhere for these people to run. You know, when I was in Haiti, some structures stood, some structures did not. In the Philippines, the size of the disaster, as I understand it, is the size of the East Coast. It was just level. There just wasn't anything left. I mean, there weren't even palm trees that were. And they rely on
coconuts. I know, there were some spooky pictures of these sort of semi-destroyed palm trees.
Yeah, the pictures I had sent you were somewhere from the air, from the helicopter, somewhere from the ground. And, you know, these people, their livelihood is coconuts, you know, to a great degree. And it was gone. Yeah.
Their lumber is from coconuts. It's a food source.
Yeah.
And so what were the people eating and drinking?
Well, this is interesting that you bring up diet and nutrition because, you know, as a naturopath, that's my keen understanding. And a lot of the illnesses that happen in developing countries happen because of everyday life activities, not just something they contracted because of something that doesn't happen every day. So these folks eat fish and rice primarily. In fact, I lived on fish and rice for most of the time I was there. You know, I brought MREs and things like that, which, you know, canned tuna and things like that. But they live on a very high sodium diet. And so a large part of the population has hypertension. And they're not necessarily eating always healthy food. And so a large part of the population has diabetes. Again, these are kind of common things that happen in developing countries. After the typhoon, they just would eat whatever they could eat. Now, this might be a little bit graphic, but the people that did not survive that were in the ocean, the fish were eating, and were eating those fish. So they continued to eat some of the sources of food that they had left. And I will say that there were, like for instance, Manila, which is an hour and a half away, resources that could be brought there. So, you know, enormous amounts of food was brought in from other locations for these people. There were trucks that big, large trucks with bags and bags of rice that was just being handed out, you know, as relief efforts.
So there was a lot of relief food to the extent that they could. People were still fishing.
Yes, yeah.
Although I imagine a lot of boats were destroyed too.
Right, so then they're fishing off the shore. And, you know, these are very industrious people. And you just see the smallest little thing that they can make work. They don't have any more wheelbarrows, so they get a stick and they put a wheel on it and they put a hook on it and they just put a bucket of water on that hook and they put that on their shoulder. And it's just amazing what they can kind of come up with. Well, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. Yeah.
That's actually something I was going to ask you about, was whether you saw cultural strengths that turned into the kind of resilience that flourishes during a disaster.
You know, I have to say that in the places that I've traveled around the world, the Philippine people are these kind of beautifully warm, emotional human beings, big, beautiful eyes. And there was just something really different about these people. They're so welcoming. You know, I worked in Africa, and they're also beautiful people, but you know the tribes I work with, they're warriors. So there's a difference. And the Philippine people were just so generous. If they had one little thing to give you, they would give it to you. You know, it was kind of just awesome to feel the appreciation that these people demonstrated when we brought medicine or when we brought them food. They were just, it was just lovely for us to witness that and be part of that. I was happy to serve them. One of the new experiences I had on this tour that I haven't had elsewhere was being involved in recovering those that did not survive. I worked with a group out of Manila called Makati Rescue, Search and Rescue. And I did this for a few days, though the majority of the time I spent treating patients. I treated about 630 patients in the couple weeks I was there. Of course, not all of those are severe, and many of those were, you know, you didn't do a full assessment on. They just needed, you know, quick care. But I worked with Makati Search and Rescue, and they had a canine rescue unit, and we retrieved those that did not survive. And that was a really kind of interesting physical, emotional process. You're going through debris, you're cutting through trees and down debris and getting into buildings that have been destroyed and pulling out you know, non-survivors, and placing them in the Philippine Red Cross bags that we were supplied and putting them out on the roadside for another agency to pick up. And that was, I'd say, you know, as an EMT, you kind of face things that you have to just shut off the emotion and just do your job. And that was kind of the case in this particular, you know, trying to wonder what happened to this person. Why am I picking up a mother and a baby and putting them in a bag? And what were they doing when this happened? There isn't really room to start to process that. You just got to do your job, and it's part of the sanitation and cleanup. And it was amazing how well these dogs could find the non-survivors.
Oh, my goodness. Now, do those bodies ever get matched up with their families of the people who did survive?
So this is an interesting dialogue. I don't know much about the Philippine government other than what villagers were telling me, which is I would arrive at a village and I would witness a mass grave that was uncovered. And I'd say, wow, does the government know this? Because part of the resource of people that come from developing countries is asking questions and trying to connect the dots. I said, should we alert the military, which we worked with, to come and witness what is right here? And they said, oh, no, the military's been out. And I said, okay, and did they, you know, go through this mass grave? Oh, no, they do not want to count how many bodies are in there. The government, I was told, and I don't have first-hand experience, does not want to exceed the cap amount of 6,000 deaths because of some issues about whether they responded well or not to the disaster.
So it may be well over that.
I believe that, because I witnessed a lot more death, and I'm just one person, I believe the number is much greater than 10,000. Yeah, so these bodies were sometimes put in mass graves, sometimes they were burned, sometimes they were collected, sometimes they were identified, sometimes they were not. We were involved in searching for some VIPs. We knew certain individuals that were prominent, and we were told to go find them, and this is the area that they might be in. And so we were able to do that and locate certain individuals.
Did you find them?
We did, yeah.
How did you deal with that when you got home? I mean, did you have to then, all the stuff that you had to keep aside emotionally when you were there doing your job, does it come up later?
So this is the, you know, critical incident, CISD issue when you see a disaster.
CISD?
Yeah, critical incident syndrome. Mostly what's in my mind is seeing families living under a tarp and just thinking about their existence. I guess I'm less concerned about those that are not on the planet anymore. So I don't feel too emotional about anything other than the survivors and what they're going through. And, you know, the media has not covered this in recent weeks. I think there were a few days after the disaster. And it's just an enormous calamity there that I witnessed firsthand, and I just do not see any media coverage anymore on.
So it's a real problem with the media, except for Democracy Now, who I think are pretty good at doing follow-up in general. But a disaster happens, there's a lot of media attention, and then you forget about the aftermath.
Yeah, and, you know, they kind of move on, and there's the, I think they call it the media fatigue or something like that, disaster fatigue. And, you know, one of the reasons I like talking about this is I really want to bring awareness to what's going on that I've witnessed personally and share with people through pictures and words. Because people still need help there.
I imagine sanitation is a huge problem.
Sanitation was a problem before the typhoon and certainly after. And in fact, sanitation is a big part of what doctors do, is they do education. So, you know, I'm working with babies who are 2 or 3 years old, who weigh 5.3 kilos and they should weigh 15 kilos. And that is because that baby is not getting enough breast milk. In this particular case, the parents had left, and the baby was left with a grandmother, and she couldn't afford to give the baby water or drink. And you know, you see these sunken fontanelles on a two-year-old, and you do education with the caregiver and say, look, if you feel that this baby's head is somewhat sunken in, it means it's not getting enough breast milk or water. And, of course, you encourage them to drink water. And back to your question, are you encouraging them to drink dirty water because of the sanitation? So you explain to them to boil water. And this is, again, a really common theme in disaster and developing countries. And so you provide clean water if you have resources. And, you know, I can't tell you how many thousands and thousands or hundreds of thousands of bottled water came in. And there was a group that provided, from the United States, that provided a wind and solar powered filtration system for water. And there was another group that came in and had rented water trucks and was transporting clean water from hundreds of miles away in big 5,000-gallon tankers and bringing it to villages and filling up these large balloon-like structures that would hold water and be able to dose it out as they needed it. But, yes, sanitation's huge, which leads to disease, dehydration, and diarrhea and all these things, you know.
We're talking to Dr. Andrew Lustig about the aftermath of the typhoon in the Philippines. One of the things that I was reading about the Philippine disaster is that whereas in many other places when there's a hurricane or a tsunami or whatever, people get relocated, but in this particular case, a lot of people were staying put because there was no place to relocate. What did you see?
Well, as far as I understand, people were given almost a week, or at least 5 days, I believe, of notice to evacuate. And they don't have the resources to evacuate. They have one house, you know, and so some people did stay put, and some survived and some didn't. What I noticed is that, you know, people that did survive, would just collect whatever debris they could cobble together and make a house out of it, or you know, get something to cook with, or whatever. And they were just kind of placed in and among the debris. Imagine an entire city of 200,000 people leveled. You have to take that entire city and lift it off of that island and dump it somewhere so that you can start to rebuild where that material was. And there were, you know, enormous bulldozers, but it was like a needle in a haystack. You're taking a dump load away, and the entire city's got to be removed.
Where does this stuff go?
That's a good question. I don't know how you take an entire island and put it somewhere else, but I imagine a lot of it's getting dumped in the ocean. And what Tacloban City needs and what the Philippines needs is a sustainable plan for reconstruction, medical care, and long-term economic growth now that there's nothing there. And there are agencies from around the world, though I will tell you that primarily the agencies that I witnessed and I think that are making the greatest strides there are agencies and governments that are local, China, Korea, Japan. I did not see as many worldwide governments and agencies helping as I did in Haiti, and for some reason maybe Haiti had a better publicity person or group to get, you know, the proximity to the United States, of course, didn't hurt.
One of the stories that one hears pieces of is the failure of or the incompetence of the kind of aid that first world countries give. They'll go to a place for a few months and then leave, but you can't accomplish what you want to in a few months. And we had a very articulate gentleman on the air the other day talking about the importance of, first of all, listening to the people as opposed to just giving them your ideas. I mean, it's a huge problem. Even when the money and resources are there, sometimes the result doesn't really help nearly as much as it should, and sometimes it's even counterproductive.
Right. This is the forever problem. You know, we can give as much as we can give, but, you know, one of the reasons I can go to these places is because I know I'm coming home. So you try to do the best you can. Essentially, you can't offer them a lifetime supply of medicine. What you hope is that when you leave, a new team comes in, and when they leave, another team comes in, and so on and so on. The question I always get wherever I'm traveling and working, whether it's Africa, Nepal, and Nicaragua, or here, is that they always say, well, when are you coming back? And I do go back, but I can't tell them exactly when, and I can't tell them how often. And so you try to offer sustainable methods for them to continue. So if, for instance, there is a herb or a certain plant that grows there that will help them with respiratory issues, rather than you just giving them some medicine that's going to run out, this is part of the education process that I offer because I have an understanding of botanical plants and minerals and so on.
Which puts you a step ahead of a lot of doctors.
Well, I wouldn't say it puts me a step ahead. We all have a place there. It puts me in an area to complement the team. Okay, so you do need IV and oral antibiotics, and that is not typically medicine that a naturopath doctor works with. But what I was able to do was say, listen, you have this herb here. Can you use this when this product runs out? And I would also find out what they're doing there. I would say, well, what do you usually do for this? And instead of taking my little orange pill, would you consider doing that? And so, you know, putting the idea back in their head that some of the resources they have right there in their backyard. And even something as simple as what's called urine therapy, which is used to kill fungal infections. And people understand they have the medicine in their body, and this is kind of coming from the naturopathic approach where you can use urine to kill fungal infections. And it's a very wet climate there, and there's a lot of fungal infections, and they're making the medicine in their body to heal that. And so we could give them a topical antifungal, which we did, but then I would explain to them, listen, when this runs out, you've got the medicine right there.
Is there a pretty developed culture of traditional medicine there?
You know, more and more what I see in the Philippines and I see elsewhere is that the people from the West and the people from Europe come and they offer these magic pills. And the people say, oh, this is great. I don't have to go outside, go cut some leaves down, go boil them and, you know, put them, you know, oh, I got this pill that'll do it. It's easy. And so, yes, they all do have, many of these places have some, like, you know, curandero or some medicine person. I mean, they deliver their babies themselves and, you know, they don't have to go to hospitals for that. But when they get kind of wowed by some of our pills that do magical things, they will tend to rely on them. So it's a kind of a mixed blessing what we're doing, but we're there for them and we do the best we can. So
what's the next step for you?
Well, one of the things that that happened in this trip that's different from the other places I've been is I reconnected with a lot of people that I worked with in Haiti. I met a lot of new doctors from around the globe. And now I think what I want to do, and I've already started the process with a few MDs, some from Denver, some from California, some from Kansas, and some from Manila, is putting together an immediate medical response team that will deploy as a group, as an NGO, to disasters within 48 hours. And that team would include doctors and nurses and EMTs, but it would also include a psych unit so that we can deal with psychological issues. It would even include a rescue unit because if you deploy within 48 hours, you're obviously going to be looking for live people versus cadavers. And it would also include a communication specialist. I used an awesome technology. Basically, it's a satellite in a suitcase, and I was actually able to communicate with the outside world and say, hey, when you come, can you bring this medicine? Or when you come, do you have an extra nurse or whatever? And so that company, GTR, has offered some pro bono. It's a very expensive device. It's $150,000, but it really opens you to the rest of the world because you lose communications in disasters. And if you can show up with a suitcase that opens you to communicate with the world, you can get more resources in. And so our team's going to include that, and we're just in the process of putting this together. And even somebody that can entertain children and get them playing and singing, if they're not injured, our team would include that too.
So there's a whole subculture of doctors and healthcare people who, for whatever reason, have the calling to go to disaster areas.
Yeah. You need the flexibility, you need the schedule, you need the desire, and you need the fortitude to live on tuna or MREs for a while and be interested in, I hate to say it, the adventure, because this is an adrenaline rush. You know, I felt so physically strong doing what I was doing. It took me 2 weeks to get back that energy when I got home, because you're just running on adrenaline. And some of us are adrenaline junkies, though, even us that have done it a long time still kind of desire a little bit of that rush. But mostly I think it's a humanitarian calling. My life right now is about, how do I help other people? How do I serve other people? That wasn't my life 8 years ago because I was a corporate executive. And in fact, I probably did the opposite. But I think that, you know, we work with some really great people that really are there. They're there on their own dime. They're there on their own time. They want to be of service. When I come back from a place like this, I feel really energized that I have helped. I haven't just listened to it on the news. I have actually done something about it. And there are people that are 25 years old that just get on a plane, they've never done this before, and somehow they feed 1,000 people. And there was a couple things on the news about one guy that had done that. He'd gotten a $25,000 grant to do a film clip for a movie company, and he asked them if he could use it instead to help the Philippine people. And the movie company said yes. And the guy had never been to a disaster. He's all like 23 years old. Somehow he got there. He rented passenger buses and transported goods from 400 miles away and built houses. And it was like, God bless these people that are just going to take a risk. They have no clue what they're stepping into. They're fearless. And they walk away helping thousands of people.
How did you leave being a corporate executive and go into studying medicine?
I, you know, after 2 decades of of making television and doing TV shows, it's I just became aware of that 40-something thing that happens. And, you know, there's books about the cycle of a man's life. And I got into my 40s and said, what have I really done for the world, right? I've made some music videos. I own some TV shows. And, you know, I've made some people wealthy. And now what? And it just I just decided that that wasn't enough. And I was fortunate to have that as a springboard to allow me to go to work for free in places, you know, around the globe.
So we're talking about the Philippines, and people who are listening might wonder what they can do to help. And because there's always these questions about what aid organizations are really doing good and what aren't, how can our listeners help and participate?
So there's all of this research about what percentage of your money goes to a disaster when you donate to the American Red Cross or you donate to the United Way. And I have nothing bad to say about those organizations. Whatever percentage is going is better than nothing. They have overhead. Their CEO deserves the money that he gets because he has to run a very complex organization. What I would say is those people that are looking to just easily make a donation to go to those large organizations, those people that want to really know exactly what their money is doing, want to have a first-hand experience, maybe even want to have a picture of who they're helping, I can connect them with that. My email address is andrew4health@gmail.com, A-N-D-R-E-W, the number 4, health, like as in good health, @gmail.com. And I have a tremendous amount of contacts all over the world and now in the Philippines for any kinds of donations, and I will be happy to connect those people that are interested.
Andrew Lustig is a doctor of naturopathic medicine. He is an EMT, and he's recently returned from the Philippines doing disaster relief after Typhoon Haiyan. Thank you very much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.